At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hi, everybody. Today on the show, we have Daniel Schricker. He is a composer and writer based in Adelaide, Australia, and he completed undergraduate and postgraduate studies at the University of Adelaide, being awarded a PhD in 2020. In addition to his doctoral research in the field of music composition, his academic interests include cults and fringe religious organizations. And some of his recent writings explore the theological and psychological aspects of high control groups and have led to guest appearances on cult-themed podcasts in Australia, the UK, and South Africa. He was also a presenter at the 2023 International Cultic Studies Association Conference, where he discussed some of his experiences growing up in KwaZi-Zabantu and his role in pursuing justice for survivors of the group. Here's Daniel now. I am delighted to be talking to Daniel Schricker today. It is so good that we were able to coordinate our different time zones. It's still fun for me to be thinking about having a conversation with someone across the world from me. And there's so much for us to cover today. So I would love for you to take a moment and introduce yourself to the listeners, and then we'll start talking. Go for it.
Yeah, certainly. Firstly, thank you for having me. So my name is Daniel Schricker. My academic background is actually more in the field of music. So I did my PhD in music composition. And I graduated from that in 2021, I believe it was. So yeah, the topics that we'll be discussing today are actually a bit of a departure from my academic field. But in terms of autobiographical info, so I was actually born in Germany and spent the first 8 years of my life there. That was where I first came into contact with a group called KwaZi-Zabantu in the form of conferences that they held there. And I'll discuss a little bit more about their history later, but I briefly lived in South Africa because of this group as well. And then when I was 8 years old, I moved to Australia with my mum and my sisters, and that's where I've been ever since. So I'm based in Adelaide, Australia now. And really just the last 3 years or so is when I've gotten more involved dealing with the theological and psychological aspects of high control groups or cults. And so I've done a bit of writing around that, partly because of my own experiences and also partly just because it's a subject that interests me. And yeah, it's developed in a way that I didn't quite imagine. So I've had the chance to do some interviews and speak at one of the ICSA conferences. And yeah, it's just been a really interesting journey over the last few years.
It's wonderful. And I've loved being a part of the ICSA and the organizations that came before it. I guess I'm just talking about my age now, if I know about the organizations that came before it. But I love that it is international. It really does draw from people all over the world, as well it should. This is something that is an international phenomenon, international issue. And there are times also that there are some countries that are responding to this in a better and more responsible way than other countries, which you've probably found as well. I think it's interesting also to hear about South Africa. Some of the people who are listening to this episode might know early on in the life of this podcast, I interviewed a colleague who's originally from South Africa and grew up during apartheid and talked about the conditioned response he has to people who are of different backgrounds, different races, and that he's embarrassed to say how acculturated he had become, sort of how programmed he still is, and has to talk himself out of his knee-jerk reaction almost each time. And that there is this, the culture really, and the push, the repetition of the fear-based kind of messaging that he was raised with, that has become a lifelong kind of issue for him and a mission of his to try to fight, and how that kind of programming can cause it to really linger from generation to generation. And what was so fascinating was the responses that we got to that, which was really fortifying the message. I think people, we got a lot of hate in response to saying that the system of apartheid wasn't a good and healthy one from a lot of people, right? A lot of people who said, no, it was the best ever for our country. And now the government is corrupt and before it wasn't, and all these things. And it got very personally attacking, et cetera. And it was a little hard for both of us. But I realized this is its own episode. And so we came back on to talk about this. Like, no, we were talking about people having this reaction that is palpable, that is visceral, that's angry, that's divisive, and that lingers. And there it was. And so that was a very interesting thing. So how interesting for you that you had an experience of being involved in a cultic group while there. It's multi-layered for me as I think about it. Also, being from Germany, there are a lot of places that you've been that have their own history, which is, I'm sure, made this very interesting for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's interesting that you mention apartheid, because so Kosi Sabantu, its origins was in South Africa, and the movement really began in the mid 60s, and the mission station in question was founded in the early 70s. So it's running, you know, right in this era in South African history, and you know, of course, politically and socially has a massive impact on what's going on at this particular mission station as well. But just one of your earlier points as well, in terms of the research and the interest we're seeing around the world now, something that's interesting to me is I'm going to be attending the Decult conference in New Zealand later this year. And I believe, you might be able to correct me if I'm mistaken, I believe it's kind of the first conference of its kind happening in Australasia, and that's kind of been encouraging to see. And I mean, it makes perfect sense when you think of the history of New Zealand with Gloria Vale and Centrepoint, and you know, there's a rather, I don't know if rich history is the right word, because that makes it sound like a positive thing, but there's this, you know, rather checkered past, shall we say, that the country has with certain cultic groups that have emerged.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely right. And Anke Richter's going to be on the show if her episode has not yet come out by the time yours comes out. But you know, we were talking about, we've known each other for quite some time, and you know, I've talked to her over the years about how I have a lot of people who I offer consultations to who have been involved in cultic groups, who are in Australia, who are in New Zealand, who are in, you know, areas around there, and where there hasn't been kind of a sense of a resource of legal kind of representation should you want to go forward with something there, counselors, people who really understand. People have felt very much alone in that part of the world. And it's a shame because, yes, it's saturated with a lot of dangerous groups.
Right. There's a little interesting piece of family history actually associated with Centrepoint, and that one of my relatives was one of the founding leaders of the group and ended up going to jail as a result because of some of the things they were doing. I never really had contact with them, but it's sort of kind of bizarre to think about that. And here in Australia, I mean, it's when you start looking into it, it's actually surprising how much there has been in the way of different groups. And I believe one person that I saw that you've already had on your podcast was Sarah Steele as well, who was the Let's Talk About Sects. It was the first podcast I did an interview with. And so she's done a fantastic job just raising awareness. And she just published a book fairly recently as well.
Nice. Yes, it's really good. I'm so glad people are coming forward. An interesting conversation also with a man from that part of the world who had gotten heavily involved in QAnon. He's sort of gone around talking about his experiences and not being able to find someone to talk to there. So I'm hoping that people who are able to provide counseling resources or legal assistance see that there really is a need and start to fill it in that area. So I'm really glad that you're going to be at the conference. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
I'm sure. And it's very nice. It's too far for me to go, but it's very nice to be able to meet people in person, which I hope we get to do at some point. But I would love for you to speak about your experiences sort of in a, let's look at the chronology. How did this all begin, your own experiences or your interest in this?
Yeah, certainly. Well, I might back up a little bit and just give a bit more of an overview of Kwasi Zabantu, because that's really where my story starts. So Kwasi Zabantu, like I mentioned, it was founded in South Africa by a man called Erlo Stegen. He was a Christian minister, essentially, and he claimed that at one point he became disillusioned with the lack of success in his ministry. Then one day everything changed, where he claimed that God came down in a tangible kind of way. So what they refer to as the Holy Spirit coming down. And he described it as though it was kind of a rushing wind that filled the building. And after this, according to him, a great revival broke out, and many of the Zulu people who he was ministering to were healed. They saw mass conversions, and they even claim to this day that one of the female leaders of the group was raised from the dead. So this was all documented in books. And once this religious movement gained traction, they were able to kind of start spreading to Europe initially, and they began holding conferences there. I believe it was the early 80s that began. And it was right around that time that my parents happened to be given a tape by Erlo Stegen, and they heard him preaching and they were kind of intrigued by him. He was kind of bringing a message that was, I guess, filling a gap in Europe at the time. In that religious context, a lot of it was kind of just very dead kind of traditionalism or the other extreme of the charismatic movement. And for people that were kind of seeking something that was a little bit more theologically rich and but also had an experiential aspect to it, someone like Erlo Stegen and his message was quite appealing. And so my parents happened to then see that he was doing a bit of a tour right in their area, and they went to hear him speak. And not long after that, the movement gained enough momentum in Europe that they were able to hold the first conference there, which is something that my parents attended as well. And my mother in particular became quite involved. And so the conferences kept growing, you know, there was a lot of interest. And basically people were coming from all over Europe at that point. So Switzerland, Germany, France, Romania. And so eventually there was enough people involved in the group that they were actually able to start planting churches, like Kwasi Zabantu churches in Europe. Now, we never actually attended one of those churches in Europe, but when I was five, my mother and all of us actually went to South Africa and lived there for 6 months at the mission station, so the headquarters of this movement. And my mother worked at their radio station, and my sisters attended the school there as well. So that was my main contact with the actual headquarters of the group. Shortly after that, we came back to Germany, and then we decided to move to Australia. And it was just a bizarre coincidence, because we did not know this ahead of time. We discovered that there was a fairly small Kwasi Zabantu church, so a group that was affiliated with the main group in South Africa, that was based here in Adelaide. And so we ended up joining this church here. And so the majority of my experience with the group was more in this kind of the smaller group that was attached and affiliated to Kwasi Zabantu. And then the only other experience actually being at the mission station was when I was 14 years old, and I traveled there with a friend, and I only spent about a month there. But I was there for a youth conference, which was interesting just to experience that. By the time I was 17 then, I was pretty heavily questioning the doctrine and some of what was happening in the church. And I addressed my concerns with the leaders in our particular little group. And as you can imagine, I didn't get too far. But through that process, eventually, I left the group, and I was very fortunate that my family left with me, because one of the things that Kwasi Zabantu does a lot is if people leave, they are shunned, including by immediate family. So there's this very typically cultic mentality of, you know, you're either a loyal member of the group, or if you leave, that's it. You know, you're kind of dead to us. So yeah, I was very fortunate in that regard. That's probably the most important points to cover in terms of the history.
Yeah. And so thank you for that. I'm curious about the youth weekends, retreats? I mean, what were they like? What took place during those things? What were you being trained to believe or to do or to lead?
Yeah, so I'll start out just by talking a little bit about the belief system as a whole, and then I'll talk specifically about the youth conferences. So Kwasi Zabantu, they market themselves essentially as being Protestant Christians, so evangelical Christians. However, they have a lot of doctrines which don't actually align with biblical orthodoxy, historically speaking. Now, they wouldn't acknowledge that, of course. In fact, you know, if you point that out to them, they'll become quite upset. But there are a number of things that are very unique. So, for example, the central doctrine in terms of how you're kind of saved from damnation is this idea that you have to confess all of your sins to one of the leaders in the group. So they call these leaders counselors. And they have this rather bizarre notion that every time you sin, you put yourself back under God's judgment. So you have a group of people that's essentially indoctrinated into a system that's completely fear-based. And because they're coerced into constantly confessing, you know, all of their misdeeds to the leaders, it also gives the leadership an inordinate amount of control over what's happening in their membership. Now, again, they wouldn't claim that this is what's motivating them. They see it more as a, you know, following a biblical command. But that's essentially the main aspect of their doctrine that's very distinct from, you know, even conservative evangelicalism. The other thing that's worth mentioning in terms of their belief system is they have a very extreme view of courtship and the whole marriage process. So dating and courtship is just not allowed at all in any capacity. So the way people get married at Kwasi Zabantu is a young man will essentially choose a woman that catches his eye. He's not allowed to interact with her because there's no interaction between the singles that, you know, the young adults. Now, they'll always frame it as God showing them to propose to someone, but, you know, so then the man, you know, once he's chosen someone that he fancies, he will go to one of the leaders in the group and he'll say to the leader, you know, God's shown me to propose to this woman. And then the leader will do it on the young man's behalf. And so then the woman is given the choice. She can actually say no to the marriage. So it's not arranged in a, you know, traditional sense of that word. But she is then encouraged to pray about it. Very often, she would also be told that she shouldn't discuss it with family or friends. It was shrouded in a great deal of secrecy. And so she would then pray about it. And if she accepted the proposal, she would go to the pastor and say, you know, yes. And then they still wouldn't be allowed to interact. They would get engaged in a church service. And in the service, the preacher would still stand in between the couple. And they'll always make a big thing of this. So this is still representing their separateness. And the pastor will even be the one that puts the ring on the girl's finger. And then throughout the engagement period, they're still completely separate. So they're not allowed to date or speak or text or anything like that. Then they get married. So the wedding ceremony, of course, is a church service again. And yeah, the first time they're alone then is on what I imagine must be a very awkward wedding night. And that's something that's so central to their belief system that to deviate from that in any way, shape, or form is to be excommunicated from the group. I mean, I know people that were expelled simply for, you know, accepting candy from someone of the opposite sex and things like that. So it's enforced, you know, absolutely rigidly.
Yeah, yeah. So to respond to that, I mean, that it's fascinating. It's not unlike really arranged marriages in a lot of ways, because I do think that there are a number of people who might seem like they're given a sense of agency and independence to be able to pray about something to see if it's what they want. When you're involved in a whole system, though, where you are learning from a very young age that you can't disappoint the people around you, if you get any inkling, I think, that the pastor or anyone else would be disappointed by you not choosing a person, I think, you know, you're going to feel that your prayers have led you to accepting who the church thinks you should be marrying. So I don't know at some point how much of a choice you actually really feel that you have. It might even be just sort of performative to make it seem like you do. But then there is the other piece about the pastor being the one, the leader being the one to put the ring on the finger. I mean, really, it's like you're marrying the church, you're marrying the leader as a conduit for everything. And that is very powerful. What a powerful message that is.
Yeah. And of course, you know, the belief system has encouraged, especially the young women, you know, marriage is one of the highest held kind of ideals within the group. Now, I do know some women that have said no, but I imagine it's very difficult because, of course, you never know when another proposal is going to come along. And, you know, you have no control over that, of course, as well. And so, yeah, there's a lot of problematic aspects to the system in that respect, certainly. But sorry, the one other thing I wanted to touch on was just in regards to the youth conferences. So they hold them twice a year, so mid-year, end-year. And now they're attended by several thousand children normally. And they're not just from within the group, so they get kids from all over the country. And I mean, essentially, it's mostly just them preaching their brand of Christianity, you know, heavily emphasizing the confessions that I've mentioned, and their kind of standard of what they consider to be purity. But one of the insidious things about some of the youth conferences and just the treatment of children in general was they had this habit of playing these incredibly violent and disturbing films for very young children. So I remember when I was at the youth conference in 2005, one of the movies they showed in the evening session was Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. I don't know what the rating is over in the US, but I believe it's probably MA or R rated or something. Now, they were playing this to a group of children. Some of them would have probably been as young as 8 or so. Many of them were there without their parents present. You have this very problematic sort of view of or lack of understanding around psychological trauma. And another one of the really popular films which got played just in general, but also at youth conferences, was a film called The Burning Hell, which is exactly what it sounds like. And it was a fundamentalist Christian preacher by the name of Estes Pierkun who made these rather horrifying sort of, they play almost like B-grade horror movies, but it's quite literally a depiction of hell. And this was one of their favorites to play to children, you know, even as young as 4 and 5 years old. And it's just very, very graphic with people burning and that kind of thing. And its intention very explicitly was to coerce, you know, the children into adopting the belief system and, you know, kind of devoting their loyalty to their brand of Christianity. So yeah, that was, I mean, there was a lot of problematic aspects in their treatment of children, but that was one specifically connected to the youth conferences that was very troubling.
Right, right. Oh, it's very troubling. And right, it goes along with so much of what I see about there not being any sensitivity about terrorizing children to keep them in line, to make sure that they follow the right path, according to this group. I know that there are a number of people who have talked to me about being exposed to visuals. I mean, even when I talk to people raised in Jehovah's Witnesses with the tracks, you know, with the depictions of the fires of hell coming up through the cracks in the sidewalk, I know there are people who said that they couldn't watch a romantic film. They couldn't watch, when they were young, they couldn't watch a romantic film. They couldn't watch anything that depicted people who were gay in any positive way, but they could watch The Exorcist. And then they have nightmares, and then they, you know, sometimes don't know why, because this somehow was for their benefit. The other thing that you brought up before was the pastor or a leader being seen as a counselor, and that you're supposed to disclose everything to this counselor who has no training in counseling, usually. And what I've seen is that because that is my role or my title with people at times, people will often overshare really quickly. They'll feel like that's their obligation. And I've needed to slow some people down and say, I feel like you're feeling pressured to please me, to tell me lots of things, but we've just met. So maybe you want to find out if I'm a trustworthy person, and this is how you might find that out. And maybe you want to test with just a little bit of information and then see how I respond to it before, like, you really don't have to keep sharing. But yeah, you can see the, you know, people really flooding those who are in that position thinking they're supposed to.
Right. Well, especially because in this case, it's, you know, it's backed by theological coercion, I would say, in the sense. So for example, something that they would make people do, it wasn't just if you were living at the mission or part of Kwasi Zabantu, that you kind of had to confess your sins in an ongoing sense. But something they made people do was when they first joined the movement, there would be this expectation that you basically had to go back through your entire life and then seek out one of their counselors and confess every single sin you could remember, you know, from childhood onwards. So they wouldn't see it as an explicit kind of form of coercion in that sense. But when you have this theological system that tells people essentially that there's a danger of hellfire and all of these things, if you don't do this, I mean, most people are going to comply. And I mean, for some people, I think there's perhaps even a slightly therapeutic aspect to it where, you know, there is a sense of unburdening themselves as well. So, you know, some people will speak of it in a positive way and other people found it deeply traumatizing, you know. So, you know, that's another interesting thing. And just your comparison there, of course, in the role that you occupy to it, it must be interesting from your perspective.
It's very interesting. Yeah. I think what's also interesting is about this idea of disclosing sins and what a sin is. And so often within these groups, sins are just sort of natural proclivities or thoughts or things that, right, that are given that moniker of, you know, being a sin. It's reminding me of the people who were in the ICC, originally started as the Boston Movement, but the International Church of Christ, where there is the sin study that they do, and you have to have lots of things on your sin list, and that they would keep adding to the list because they could see that the person they're talking to was genuinely disappointed when there were only a few things on the list. And people would then have to draw, well, I one time felt jealous of someone getting a pair of shoes that I liked. Ah, put that on the list, you know, and it sort of made the audience who they were talking to happy to have you show that you were really a sinner and that therefore you needed saving.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds very, very similar to some of what was happening at Kwasi Zabantu as well. And I mean, I've heard, you know, children who later left who said, you know, sometimes they would just make up sins. Because, for example, at the school on the mission, they had, I believe it was a weekly session for each child where they had to go and see their counselor and confess their sins. And so for some children, they ended up just making things up because, I mean, you know, how much could they do wrong in a week, especially in a system that was so controlling of their behavior? But I think what's really insidious about that is that it turns, you know, normal parts of our humanity into something that is viewed as evil. So, for example, I've got a friend that, and this was a pretty common experience for young people because there was such a paranoia surrounding romantic and sexual attraction. When you were in your teens and, you know, you had a crush on someone or something like that, that was immediately deemed to be sinful. So oftentimes young people are going and confessing that, well, I like this girl or whatever. And, you know, thinking that there's something deeply wrong with them, not realizing, of course, that they're kind of just, that it's a no-win situation, you know, because it's just an essential part of our humanity. And there's something just really psychologically devastating about turning something like that into a sin and then making young people disclose that to older people in the group.
Yeah. That happens a lot in Jehovah's Witnesses, also being brought in front of a council of adults and having to talk about things that you've done or thought. It is what prompts, I think, a lot of people who come to counseling after to say, is this normal? Is it okay if I have thought something, done something, wanted to do something? Do other people think that way, right? Just getting a frame of reference. I'm sure it's disorienting.
Yeah. I suppose the other thing worth mentioning, especially on the subject of children, was that the level of fear that was driving all of this was considerable, not just in a theological sense where their depiction of God was primarily vindictive. So you wouldn't ever hear them preaching a sermon about God being benevolent or loving or compassionate. So everything was focused on, you know, his anger and, you know, you better follow the rules kind of thing. But, you know, part of their history as well was this very, very brutal treatment of children in the form of physical punishment. So there's been a whole process of investigations with Kwasi Zabantu over the last couple of years, which I've been involved with. And something that emerged very clearly was, you know, many, many former members coming forward and saying that they were, you know, severely beaten. And usually they would use plumbing pipes to hold children down and beat them. And this was just for trivial infractions, you know. So like I mentioned, you know, if you interacted with someone of the opposite sex as a school child or something, or, you know, if you clapped at the wrong moment during a performance or something, you know, it could be anything really. And so they were doling out these very brutal punishments. And of course, combined with the psychological aspects driving the theology, I mean, it was just it robbed the children of any sense of self, I think. And I ended up writing a series of four essays specifically on the role of fear in the theology of Kwasi-Zaabantu and the psychological implications for children, because I realized that that was kind of the common thread connecting a lot of what motivated them in terms of how they were raising their children. And it's interesting when you speak to former members. I mean, some of them have just not been able to shake some of the psychological trauma from that, you know, either because of the physical or the psychological aspects of it.
I think that, it's so sad to think about how children aren't given a chance to be children, but also they're not given any kind of grace around just the fact that you can make a mistake or that you might do something quote unquote wrong because you just don't know that it's wrong yet, or that your brain hasn't yet developed to be able to give you that sense of or that ability to have that level of self-control. And so you're really punished for things that are beyond your control, which I'm sure happens so often. In groups like this, I wonder if you felt scared when you were in it.
Well, I was somewhat fortunate in the sense that the group in Australia that I was part of that was connected with Kwasi-Zaabantu, we didn't really have the physical brutality present in the group. So the belief system was essentially the same with the confessions and the courtship process and the theology as a whole. That was pretty much identical. Alois Stegen's brother would come out to our church once a year and do kind of a preaching conference. And it was pretty common for people to go over to South Africa as well. But thankfully, we didn't have quite the same level of, physical violence as was in South Africa. I was quite an introspective child, I think. And I think it's particularly devastating for people that are more that way inclined. And because oftentimes, you know, if you have perfectionistic tendencies anyway, this theological system where, you know, God is essentially demanding perfection from you all the time is just very challenging to deal with.
Right. Absolutely. And so can you give some examples of the perfection? What standards were you held to?
Well, it's kind of, it's similar to some of the things I already mentioned, you know, even just in connection with not just actions, but thoughts as well. So like I say, you know, even natural things, you know, you develop an attraction to someone, you know, and think that something is deeply wrong with you, things like that. But yeah, it really could be anything, depending on how sensitive the person was as well, I suppose. It creates a belief system around God as well, where the way you're relating to God is almost entirely based on fear rather than, so, you know, within normal evangelical churches, I would say there's more of an emphasis on, you know, God's grace and his love. And, you know, most people will sort of be raised having some understanding of that God is kind of there for them and looking out for them. Whereas in Kwasi-Zaabantu, that just was just completely absent. You wouldn't think of God in that way. So that also helps kind of reinforce the belief system, because not only are the leaders of the group, you know, exercising a certain amount of control, but because they've convinced the members that God is always watching, you know, there's a lot that they don't have to do because, you know, the people kind of will comply just out of fear, even if they're not being supervised.
Incredible. Right. So then jumping back onto the chronology. So then take us through you leaving that group and how old were you and how that all came about and then what happened next?
So I was about 17 when I left. The first thing that sort of created some questions in my mind was just seeing the way people were being treated within the church, and specifically some instances of bullying. That sort of began me questioning the belief system as a whole. And so as a teenager, I had conversations with people that were leading our church and expressed some concerns. And yeah, I didn't really get very far. I remember speaking to the pastor on one occasion, and I expressed some concerns that we were following the leaders of this group in South Africa just completely blindly, you know. And even as a teenager, I realized that there was something unhealthy about this. And the pastor kind of feigned a degree of humility, but then the following Sunday, he got up and preached an entire sermon on how it was okay for us to be following these people because of something Paul said in the New Testament. And I remember thinking at the time that it was kind of a cowardly way to respond, you know, from behind a pulpit where there's no dialogue anymore. And I actually almost got up and left the service, but I was stopped by my mother. But basically, I said to my family, and thankfully, we've always been a family that communicates quite a lot. And so we'd been discussing things, and I basically said to my family, I'm not going back anymore. You know, this is silly. And so that was the point where we left. I mean, other than just trying to deal with the psychological effects after leaving, I didn't, you know, engage a whole lot with what was happening in the group, you know, either here or in South Africa. But then I was browsing YouTube one day and I saw like a news segment advertising this expose on a cult in South Africa. And of course, it caught my attention because I saw the name of it. And there's an organization called News 24 that did a huge expose of Kwasi Zabantu. So they produced a documentary, they did a series of podcasts, and they did, I've lost count of how many articles, but dozens of articles. And so it really created kind of a media firestorm. And as a result, an organization called the CRL Commission got involved to investigate what was happening. Now, unfortunately, that turned out to be somewhat disappointing. That's a long story as well. But so I was following the story quite closely. And my initial involvement was actually, so there's a friend of mine, Erica Bornman, who wrote an autobiographical account of growing up in Kwasi Zabantu. It's a book called Mission of Malice. And naturally, I was curious to read her experiences. And I wrote a review, and it wasn't really intended for publication or anything. It was just something I sent to her privately. And she was very excited about the review, and it did end up being published. And so that was kind of the starting point of getting a little bit involved publicly. And then I wrote the four essays that I mentioned, and those got a little bit of attention as well. And following on from that, then I did some interviews on podcasts, just discussing what was going on at KSB as well. Yeah, so eventually the whole thing turned into a somewhat ugly legal battle as well, and including with the CRL Commission, and we're still kind of hoping that there'll be a more positive outcome. It's all been very messy, but yeah, so that's kind of where things are at the moment with all of the investigations.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, it's very frustrating when there's a lot of hope that's attached to some sort of legal process, and you want it to have the outcome that you want it to have, that you want it to make a difference, you want it to be powerful, and then sometimes things do just start falling apart. And it is quite frustrating. I hope things do get resolved and there's some justice and things work out the way they, quote unquote, should, at least from our vantage point. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So the other thing that I did in the process of that was I joined Twitter, because that was kind of where I started sharing different things, not just my own writings and interviews, but I started publicly commenting on some of the services at Kwasi Zabantu, especially some of the problematic things that they were publicly airing. And I'm not sure whether this is a good time to segue into the second half of the program. So
it's a perfect time. Go for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and no, I was just going to say it was on Twitter that I encountered Laurie Alexander, who is... she markets herself as, I guess, having an online ministry of sorts. I don't know whether she would use the term influencer, but she kind of occupies that role in a sense. So she's very active on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, TikTok, you name it. She's kind of everywhere at the moment. And initially, I kind of just ignored her content because of how bizarre I found it. And, you know, it was just this extremely... hyper-patriarchal kind of message that she was sending. And all of her content is kind of based around that. And so she promotes what she calls biblical womanhood. It does it from, you know, a Christian perspective, or so she claims as well. I think that the reason that it made me eventually take notice was that I became intrigued by this idea of, like, Is it going to be something that we're facing increasingly, where people are able to gain an almost cult-like influence just through an online presence? You know, I've only ever really thought of cults or high-control religious movements in the sense of, you know, a relatively isolated group of people that then kind of spread their influence through recruitment or whatever. But I sort of became fascinated by this idea of a lot of what I'm seeing from her and her followers reminds me a lot of what I've studied, not just with Kwasi Zabantu, but in other cultic groups. And so that was kind of what made me take an interest in her and her content. And so then eventually I decided to write what ended up being quite a lengthy article and posting it online. And it generated quite a lot of discussion, and including, you know, a response from Laurie Alexander herself. And yeah, it was just kind of interesting to see that all play out, especially because, you know, the response not only from her, but from the followers kind of confirmed the central premise of my article. And that was that this ministry is very unhealthy in the sense that it's starting to occupy or demonstrate or exhibit, you know, a kind of cultic mentality and in how she is treated and the nature of her content as well.
Interesting. I feel like then we've had kind of mirrored experiences of putting something out there and then hearing back from the people who are underscoring our point about this being a place where they're being influenced. Very interesting. Right. I'm really wondering about the response that you got from Laurie. What was that? And what was that like?
Well, it was interesting. I initially wasn't sure whether she would kind of just ignore it and hope it goes away. And of course, I don't actually have a massive following on Twitter, so I wasn't sure how much traction the article would get to begin with. But apparently it gained enough that, you know, it was brought to her attention. And initially, she kind of just responded saying that there's a post going around claiming that, you know, my ministry is a cult or something to that effect. And somewhat humorously then outlined reasons that she thought was kind of in defense of her position, but which just seemed to emphasize my point more. But I suppose it's for people that are unfamiliar with her ministry, I might fill in just some of the things just so people understand what she's kind of about. So as I mentioned, she's kind of this... promotes this kind of hyper-patriarchal version of Christianity, but really only emphasizing the women's responsibility in that. So a lot of what she emphasizes is the role of women submitting to their husbands in ways that are really unhealthy, I should add. It extends to, you know, health advice, including times where she tells women to disregard medical information from doctors. You know, she gives cooking advice. And some of the common things that she's repeatedly posting about is, you know, the evils of feminism, you know, why all forms of birth control are bad, you know, why it's wrong for women to go to college, you know, why women shouldn't be voting, you know, just this very, very extreme view of kind of subjugating her own gender, I suppose. It sort of, it got me digging into it because I as you probably noticed, it's kind of a point of fascination for me what motivates people psychologically when they hold to extreme belief systems. And so it kind of just got me curious to research a little bit more about, you know, what's making this woman think this way. And as I dug a little bit deeper, it became apparent that there was a lot of influence from other forms of Christianity that are equally problematic, in my opinion. So Laurie has kind of said that she was in a marriage in which she claims she was kind of a bad wife for about 23 years or so early on in her marriage. And what she means by that is that she was, you know, very, very manipulative, very controlling, just very confrontational. And then one day she happened upon a book called Created to Be a Helpmeet by Debbie Pearl. Now, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Pearls, but they are also a sort of a brand of fundamentalism, I suppose, which has a very, very problematic history in terms of their parenting advice and their views of marriage and things like that. And anyway, this seemingly became the catalyst for Laurie to change the dynamic in her marriage and take on this very, very submissive, subservient role to her husband. And it was around that time that she began this ministry online. Now, in my article about her, I kind of speculate that perhaps there was just a shifting of the outlet of someone that desires a high degree of control. And, you know, once she gives that up in her domestic domain, it's kind of channeled into her online ministry and the feedback that she's getting from that. But of course, that's speculative on my part. That's just what I imagine happened. So once I started looking into her ministry a little bit more deeply, I particularly was interested in some of the similarities between the cults I'd looked at and the way her ministry was operating. So, for example, one of the things that immediately concerned me is that the way her husband especially speaks of her is that she's, you know, God's voice that's lifted up for this generation to proclaim truth. And I mean, if anyone who's studied cults, it's what you hear from every single religious cult is that they have some prophet or some guru that, you know, has some special access to the divine and now is going to share with us all how this is supposed to work. Now, I don't actually think in her case that she possesses the intelligence that you typically associate with narcissistic cult leaders, thankfully. But for some reason, you know, she's gained this huge following online and seems to exert a lot of influence over people with very, very harmful ideas. So yeah, then there was just a number of characteristics that kind of jumped out at me, which I cover in my article. And so you had the very typical us versus them mentality where everything within this particular brand of patriarchy is viewed as safe and the rest of the world is kind of very evil, very dangerous. You know, as soon as you step outside the bounds of this, you know, something catastrophic is going to happen. The other thing I noticed too was this overemphasis on one particular topic. I mean, just to draw a comparison to Kwesi Zabantu, you know, with Kwesi Zabantu, there was this huge emphasis on confession of sins based on one verse. In the case of Laurie Alexander's ministry, it's this, you know, almost myopic focus on her interpretation of verses that speak to the role of women submitting and patriarchy as a whole. So I just thought that was kind of interesting as well that, you know, seeing this pattern with groups that I consider to be harmful and the way they seem to have a hyper focus on one particular doctrine or verse. And that kind of gets used to underpin the entire belief system. So if you're conforming to this particular doctrine, then you're kind of part of the group. And if you don't, then you're excluded. So the other thing that I did in the article then was just looking at Stephen Hassan's bite model and just evaluating some of the aspects of a ministry against that. So the behavior control, the information control, thought control, emotional control, just some of the ways that these are playing out. And again, in a little bit of a different way, I suppose, because her ministry is entirely based online, the form that it takes is unique, I suppose. But yeah, it was just kind of fascinating to observe that. And I'm happy to go into more detail on that as well, but I'll
respond first. Right. So it's so interesting about Lori. You know, when you, after seeing that you were going to be on and we were able to find a good time to talk, and, you know, I started doing my deep dive that I like to do in my research. Among so many other things, what I found fascinating was going to this website and having her husband, Ken, write this long intro that is entitled Setting the Record Straight, right, in response to her having been attacked. And I thought that's fascinating because it's been set up so that people aren't necessarily believing her if she were, let's say, to speak on her own behalf. She needs her husband, or her husband feels that it's his role to set the record straight for her. And so even if I didn't know about this being a patriarchal group, I would have known from that, right? And that it's written, you know, by Ken. I just thought the fact that his name is Ken is so perfect. I so wish her name were Barbie. It's just this template, you know? And that's the other thing that is fascinating to me, just about how she has bought into these tropes, these stereotypes, this idea of the woman being manipulative and the temptress or whatever else, all the different things that, you know, women have been vilified for all these years, and this teaching that she used to be all of these negative things that are these stereotypes, and she then needs control. And she needs external locus of control because she doesn't have it internally. That's sort of the message I think I was getting from this. So she needs to have this structure, this system put around her so that she can control herself. Well, okay, that's fine. If that's how she feels, I think that's probably not true, because I think she was given the message that she is this manipulative woman and that she needs to be controlled and contained, but you can actually learn to have self-control. That seemed to have been skipped over because that doesn't work in the system. But then if she really needs this control, why can't she just say, this is what I need? I don't know what you all need. You could just do your thing. But I'm just saying this has been my personal journey, whether I believe, you know, that it's been necessary or not, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact that then she needs to spread it around for the masses, that this is also what all women need, and this is what men need to do. The hubris in that is palpable. And so she might not be, as you're saying, smart enough to be considered a narcissist, but there is some kind of sense of grandiosity that I know what everyone else needs.
It's the combination of her universalizing her own experience in conjunction with her particular brand of religious fundamentalism. So one of the things I mentioned in the article is that I think she seems to have trouble distinguishing her experiences, not only from the experiences of others, but from biblical principles. So I think what's starting to happen is that she's conflating her experience with God's will. That's why she attempts to universalize it, because it's not just, well, hey, here's what worked for me. You do you. It's this is what worked for me. Therefore, it's biblical. Therefore, it's God's will for everyone. Now I'm going to tell you that. And if you're doing it a different way, you're rebelling against God. Again, this is kind of where, you know, my ears pricked up a little bit in terms of just having invested so much time looking at belief system of cults. It sounded so familiar to me, that the way she was marketing her ministry and her content, where anytime she's challenged or even you know, respectful disagreement is immediately shut down. And it's these same tropes of, you know, you hate God, you hate truth. And it really felt like deja vu for me, because it's all the same things that Fussy Zapantu has said about me and people that have spoken out against them. You know, it's never, let's address the concern, let's address the point of contention. It's just an immediate dismissal on the basis that they are right because they are on God's side and everyone else is wrong. It doesn't matter how legitimate their grievance is. And yeah, I just thought it was fascinating to see someone that you know, was running this ministry in a way that was very familiar to me. And yeah, I mean, some of the response specifically to my article was actually quite comical, because so one of the things she said on a couple of occasions was that she believed that I was a woman pretending to be a man. And I thought it amused me, just because it seemed symptomatic of what's problematic about her view of women as a whole, where someone that's saying something that she doesn't like or disagrees with, it must therefore be coming from a woman, even though my name and my personal details were in the article. She seems to have difficulty assigning any kind of blame to men, you know, no matter who it is. You know, there's always this shifting of responsibility to the woman. Now, this becomes, I mean, it amused me more than anything in response to me, but one of the problematic aspects in terms of her teaching is that when this principle is applied in situations where the woman really is being victimized, or children, that becomes, you know, dangerous to say the least. So, for example, oftentimes her advice in reference to women that have married abusive men, you know, is just very, very troubling. And so, for example, something that she's advised in the past is that men that have been incarcerated for child sex offenses in relation to their own children, she encourages the women to maintain a relationship between the children and the father. You know, sort of saying that, how dare you think of yourself as being better than this man? You know, you're a sinner as well. And that's sort of, you know, I think where it becomes important to actually address some of these things, because this isn't just, you know, just a wacky brand of fundamentalism, but it's, you know, for people that are truly internalizing her message, I think potentially it has devastating consequences. And, you know, there's been other advice. So one of the things that she received a huge backlash for was describing a situation where she was giving counsel to a woman that was describing an instance of marital rape. And again, you know, assigning blame to the woman for not being sexually available to the husband, and a complete dismissal of any responsibility on his part. And so, you know, it's this very extreme extreme view in which seemingly the women, their only function is to serve the men, you know, even if it comes at their expense. It's still, honestly, it's still bizarre to me that she's managed to gain the kind of following that she has just because of how kind of asinine her content is. But I suppose that's where we are these days with, you know, the online influencer situation.
Oh, there is a limitless amount of asinineness, if we can call it that. It's just, there's a plethora and a limitless audience now that you can reach millions every second, which is terrifying. One of the things that's interesting is that I could see calling her self-hating, because I think there are people who are raised to be self-hating, to really think there's something wrong with them as them, whatever it is that is about them that they hate. And then they need saving and they need controlling, and they then deserve also to be mistreated a lot of the time, which is very terrifying. I think women also being blamed for things that are not their fault. I mean, you know, we don't need any more help with that in society. We already have a legal system here, and I don't know if it's this way where you are, but unfortunately, in some cases, all too often, when children have been abused within a household and the man of the household, if he was the one who did the abuse and he's incarcerated, there have been a number of cases where the woman, the mom, is incarcerated for longer because her role as a mother should have dictated that she could have protected these children from this, even though she was probably not able to protect herself too and was beaten down and afraid. But already there is this relegation for women to be seen as more at fault regardless. And so, no, I don't think that we need to support that notion in any way. It's already there. I wonder also just about when you were talking about her and some of the things that she says and some of the things that are disturbing. I remember also reading, I don't remember which website it was or theirs, and I don't know on what day, where they needed to clarify that there was something where they published having punished one of their kids for 4 hours. And Ken said something about how, no, it's not that we were beating this child for 4 hours. We were kind of beating them, then talking, then beating them, then talking. Like somehow that would, okay, great, thanks. That's so much better. Right, to qualify it and make it just almost as bad, you know? But having, again, no sense of, I think, what's healthy, what's right, what a child needs in those moments, but also guiding parents to parent that way. It's really, really troubling.
Right. And I mean, I assume I actually got a little bit of pushback from people who very much agreed with my article, but felt that I was being far too gracious to Laurie in the way that I wrote it, which was interesting. Because of course I got a lot of very, very hateful comments from her supporters, which I was, you know, somewhat expecting that. Fortunately, the ones that were supportive of me, you know, addressing concerns were much more polite. But and my response to that, particularly in regards to the children, and I wonder what your perspective on this would be as well, is that I extend her a little bit more grace, just in the sense that she's obviously from a generation where the James Dobson style of parenting was kind of the norm, as far as I understand it, especially in the US. So, for example, the concept of giving your child a spanking or something is not particularly shocking if you've grown up in those circles. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think there's just a lack of self-awareness on their part, you know, to put out a story like that, you know, about disciplining their children in that way and then sort of reacting with shock when people are horrified by it. I just think, well, what did you expect was going to happen? You know, is there really that much of a lack of self-awareness that surrounding their actions that they don't realize how this is going to be received from people not in their little circles? So yeah, that's kind of extraordinary.
Yeah, to be, I think, so cocooned in this space where you don't have a frame of reference, where you haven't read a real parenting book, child development book, all of it. I remember when people would say to me, well, you know, sometimes you just need to hit your kids, and or you know, how often do you scream at your kids? And I remember thinking, I mean, there was one time that they were running across the street to catch a ball and a car was coming. Then I did scream. I had to get
right.
their attention.
Well, fair enough.
But other than that, it's never necessary, ever necessary. I mean, you can choose that as part of your parenting, but then don't be shocked that your child isn't screaming at other people or feels terrible about themselves or is scared of you. You know, that's the end result. So I think that there are a lot of people who really could benefit from learning how to do it well and in a healthy way or whatever. I'm not saying mine is that I was perfect anyway, but I didn't do those things. And so the shame for me is when someone has an audience of millions and this is how they're spending that access, you know, with sort of filling people with these notions that are unhealthy for them, unhealthy for the next generation. It's such a missed opportunity to me. But I wanted to make sure also to just ask you about this idea of extreme beliefs, because if you're studying people who really ascribe to this or adhere to it or take on extreme beliefs, I'd love to see what you were able to find out about what that means, what that is for, what that means about the person, because not everyone is attracted to that. And I know sometimes it's a who issue, sometimes it's a when issue. Sometimes people will be attracted to an idea at a certain time in their life when they wouldn't have before. I would love to just explore that point with you.
Well, I suppose I can mostly comment on it in connection with religious ideology, because that's kind of my realm of experience. And to me, the defining factor really as to whether people adopt it is simply whether or not they believe that this really comes from God or not. So in the case of Kwasi Zabantu, if you buy into their story of this alleged revival that happened with God coming down and the resurrection of one of their leaders, of course you're going to buy into the belief system because you've bought the premise, you know, of their whole religious movement. And one of the things I wish there was a little bit more attention on, someone has written a book debunking this whole revival story of Kwasi Zabantu, but I think if you can get people to question that, they will then have permission to question the belief system. But until you establish in their minds that this may in fact not be from God, there's really nothing you can say to them that will get through, because, you know, how is the word of a person ever going to compete against the word of God? It's the same thing with Laurie Alexander. I think that the issue is that she sincerely and very deeply believes that she is speaking God's truth. Megan Phelps Roper once wrote something interesting about the Westboro Baptist Church that she grew up in and her process of leaving. It occurred through someone pointing out an inconsistency within her own worldview. And she says that, you know, she was used to people attacking the belief system of the church, but it was always from the outside. So she had been very, very well trained to dismiss them, you know, immediately. Because in fact, so much of what they did, and this is true of most cultic groups, is they expect resistance. And in fact, they often frame it as righteous persecution. You know, the turning point for her was someone, a Jewish man, I believe, coming along and saying, by the way, you've misunderstood this particular passage in scripture. That's, you know, and showing her an internal inconsistency, which created enough of a cognitive dissonance that she kind of started pulling that thread until it unraveled. And I think in the case of someone like Laurie Alexander, the only way I could see that she would ever begin to do any kind of self-reflection is if someone from within her own camp that she really respected and that she considered to be part of her brand of Christianity came along and said, hey, by the way, this isn't good. This isn't biblical. Now, it's possible that she may not listen, even if that happened. I'm not sure how, you know, how much hubris there is attached to it. I suspect a great deal, but that's really the only chance I can see of anything changing there, because as long as someone, you know, sincerely believes that what they teach is the will of God for people, I just don't see any way to challenge that and have them do any kind of self-reflection.
Mm. It's interesting, right? I agree with you. And I think it's very hard for people when things start breaking down to want to really look at that too, because if you really have followed that equation, that this is the word of God, so then it's the truth and you need to follow it. And if a piece, the X, sort of gets shifted, then everything falls apart. And I think there are a lot of people who who have said to me, I was already questioning things for quite some time, but I couldn't say it. I was afraid to really see it, because then what would my life be? And would I have been wasting all my time believing this or believing that person? It's really, it's quite a big thing to do. So I'm thinking, especially leaving, being a child of the leadership of the Westboro Baptist Church, the amount of courage it takes to, even in your own mind, have it start to, the equation to start to disintegrate, that it takes a lot of bravery, actually.
Oh, absolutely. I actually got to hear Megan Phelps-Roper speak very briefly here in Adelaide. She, Louis Theroux, did a tour to Adelaide, and she made a brief appearance as part of that. Very, very intelligent, articulate woman, you know, and yeah, I have immense respect for her. I mean, in addition to what you said as well, especially when it's accompanied, as in the case of Westboro or Kwasi Sabantu, you know, when it's backed by this belief system that if you leave, you know, you open yourself up to eternal damnation as well. You know, there's no permission to question anything at that point. I don't think someone really has the freedom, you know, until they allow themselves to think beyond that and, you know, start tugging at those threads. And I really enjoyed Megan Phelps-Roper's book. I think it's one of the best sort of memoirs of someone that's left a high control group.
It's fantastic. I'm so glad that she's out there. You've mentioned high control groups, and there are people who will wonder what that is. I mean, you know, there have been people on the podcast who have talked about 12-step, talked about being in the military, talked about being multi-level marketing in conspiratorial groups in white supremacy. My goal of doing this podcast, among other things, is to show that these kinds of things exist in many different forms. And so don't just look for someone in orange robes on a mountaintop and that's the cult to watch out for. That it's more about the control and differentiating just something that might be controlling and manipulative to it being really graduating into the high control cultic kind of system that you need to really try to avoid at all costs or try to notice sooner than later. And so what are some of the things that you think would be good based on your experience and your research that people really need to watch out for when they're getting involved in something, or that they can look at something they're already involved in to see if it's a high control group?
Right. In connection with specifically religious ones, thankfully, there's a lot more awareness around other cultic groups. And when you said about the army, was it Uncultured by Daniela Mastrzaniak-Young?
Yeah.
It was another book I enjoyed. But yeah, just thinking of something like that in cultic terms is an interesting idea. But yeah, in terms of religious high control groups, I suppose one of the things that is important to me in the way that I approach the subject is not to fundamentally oppose religion, but rather to distinguish healthy from unhealthy religion. So, for example, I have no issue with church or, you know, people subscribing to religion. And one of the things that I've actually found to be the most effective in helping people come out of a high-control religious group specifically is to demonstrate to them historically that their particular group has actually deviated from the faith that they claim they subscribe to. So one of the main things I did when I was speaking to the CRL Commission about Kwasi Sabantu is I spoke about the doctrines that I mentioned, their confession and their marriages. And I pointed out that this really has no precedence within historical Christianity. This is a something of their own invention. Because that was one of the things that really made me start to question was that, you know, I read sources by other Christians and I realized, hey, they're getting married, you know, in a normal way and they see no conflict with the Bible. You know, maybe this isn't something that we've cornered the market on in our group. I think that's something that's very important, is just differentiating between healthy and unhealthy belief systems, even within Christianity or whatever religion it is. And yeah, I think that's more effective perhaps than just coming along and trying to persuade people to reject the belief system as a whole, because for most people, that's going to be a step too far, at least initially. Whereas kind of what I mentioned in relation to Megan Phelps-Roper, I think if you can point out inconsistencies within their own worldview, in particular, in comparison to the wider evangelical world or historically, as I mentioned, I think you have a greater chance of getting them to actually reflect on the belief system of the group and to realize that, you know what is so all-encompassing in our minds is actually just this very, very tiny group of people in the large scheme of things that hold to this particular worldview.
Right. And I like the way you're talking about it, in that you know, when you provide someone with this sort of little bit, like it planting a seed, like, why don't you look at this? You don't have to leave. You can choose to at some point if the seed germinates into something that becomes sort of too great to step around to be able to see that there is any benefit for you staying. But I think then you're treating people really respectfully in a way that they haven't probably been treated before, because they've been told you have to believe this. And that's why, like, if I ever do an exit counseling, a non-forcible intervention, it's never to just to pull somebody out, but it's to say, would you like to look at this? And I would hope that's how I would be treated. If someone wanted to point out, let's say, a relationship I were in were not a healthy one, as opposed to you can never go back there, but let's talk about this piece of it, you know, and see what you think. And then see if that thread has things unravel, but that you feel like you were able to provide that for yourself, which is very not cultic, actually.
Yeah. It's always interesting to see how these kinds of groups, or in the case of Laurie Alexander, an individual, how do they respond when they are faced with criticism? And in the case of Kwasi Zabantu, you know, I mentioned there was this big expose labeling them a cult. And it was kind of fascinating to watch their response, you know, tick all of the boxes of how a high control group typically responds to accusations or allegations. You know, it was always everyone else is lying. We're being persecuted because we're the true believers. You know, all of the same kinds of rhetoric that you always see. And I just think, you know, if you're in a situation where you're part of a group that is facing criticism, you know, just observe the reaction of the leaders and ask yourself whether it's healthy. Like, are they showing any of the humility? I mean, something, for example, that's quite ironic about the way Kwasi Zabantu responded to allegations is that the whole emphasis of their ministry is this idea of confession and admitting when you've done something wrong. But of course, that doesn't apply to the leadership when they actually have done something wrong. And again, to me, it's about showing that internal inconsistency in their worldview of saying, hang on, they're demanding from all of their followers that they confess every thought, every fleeting emotion. And yet, you know, they've been accused of some really serious allegations here. And all of a sudden, it's all denial and, you know, attacking. I actually wrote an article on Davo in relation to Kwasi Zabantu and the way that they responded. You know, you wish you could say to the people in that group, just watch what's unfolding right now that they're experiencing this criticism, and ask yourself whether that is a reasonable response from your leadership. But one final thought on that subject. My experience is that typically what is the catalyst for people questioning to the point that they're willing to leave is not actually so much finding flaws or deficiencies in the belief system. It's some personal grievance that they experience in the group that then prompts them to question the belief system. So very often what I hear from people is they experience some kind of mistreatment from the leadership or someone they were close to did. And it's almost like they're realizing for the first time, these people aren't quite as virtuous and righteous as I thought they were. And, you know, that often then leads to questioning more broadly about the group. It's pretty rare in my experience for someone to simply question the belief system itself without something kind of acting as a catalyst on a experiential, personal level, you know, where there's something that really disturbs them and they feel the need to start looking into it.
Right. Yeah. And I think it's a wonderful guideline to really look at, to really notice, because I think when you're in it, it's hard to notice. Do the rules just apply to you and not the leadership? Same thing with being in a healthy relationship. Do the rules only apply to you? Right. I love that. That's great. Great reminder. Thank you so much, Daniel. It's really been a treat to talk with you, to learn from you, to get your sharing of your experiences and your research. And I hope we get to talk again. This was wonderful.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
My pleasure. Yeah. One more thing before you go. Thank you, Daniel. Thank you for teaching us about this group. There are so many groups like it. It really is astounding. I know that I get calls about groups like this so often where people just cannot believe that this exists, and it exists right under people's noses and sometimes right in their faces, and it still continues to go on. I find it so troubling when people in groups like this are there because they want to make their life better, because they're open-hearted, because they want to be good people, because they want to do good things for so many others in the world. But the person in charge does not at all have good intentions for them. It is another one of these situations of, well, if we could get the leader out of the way, the people in the group would have a pretty good experience, I think, and would treat each other much more respectfully. It is such a dangerous thing also to be in an organization where you are told that the person you're talking to is a person you have to tell everything to, that the person you're talking to is considered a counselor. But just so you know, counselor is not a legally recognized term. It's not a regulated term. Anyone can call themselves a counselor. And so they're not necessarily qualified to hear your confession. They're not qualified to be able to respond to anything that you confess in any healthy way, in any psychologically knowledgeable way, in any sensitive way. But here people will open up in every way to the person who calls themselves a counselor. And what I find also very troubling is that in a group like this, there is no kindness. The leader is someone you're supposed to be afraid of. The leader is someone who will physically harm you. The leader is someone who will endanger you. The leader is someone who will allow you to be hurt and harmed and traumatized. And the leader is someone who's going to hold you to a standard that is much beyond any standard he has ever needed to live by. If you do anything to make him upset, if you just don't bring in the homework that you're supposed to bring in when you're in school there, you get hit, you get hurt. And in some school systems across the world, that is still the norm. Corporal punishment is still the norm, unfortunately. It doesn't help people learn. And when you motivate people through fear, they then have a connection to everything with fear. So it is so often the case that people will say to me, I was hit if I didn't pay attention in class. I was hit if I didn't understand something right away. I was hit if I was seen as lazy, which doesn't leave any room for any child to have any issue, like a learning disability, like an attentional issue. Everything is seen as purposeful misbehavior. And then when you are under this kind of gauntlet, this fear all the time of being hurt, of being humiliated, then you have a harder time concentrating. You have a release of adrenaline, which is going to interfere with your ability to think, with your ability to remember, with your ability to answer the question on the test correctly. So they are setting you up for failure and then punishing you for failing. That shows how little they know. I think it's very, very important that Daniel investigates groups like this, that Daniel gets to teach us about high control groups in other parts of the world, and groups not unlike other groups we hear about here, who are patriarchal, talk about their definition of biblical womanhood, and have men deciding everything for women and deciding how they should be as women. Nothing new, unfortunately. What is different, though, about groups like this is that the world doesn't necessarily hear about them. And so when people come forward, when they've been in a group that people haven't heard of, they can feel alone. All the more reason that we like to have people on the show who not only can talk about groups that have popular names, but also the groups that have kind of gone into the shadows or under the radar, in order to bring light to them and in order to honor people's trauma and experiences there. Thank you to Daniel for sharing this important information with us today. Take good care, everyone. Talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.